There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home, plus fast and free shipping site-wide. Shop now through July 28th at wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. As we head into the holidays, there is no shortage of news. Bashar al-Assad, the vicious dictator of Syria, has fled. Now, Israel is conducting bombing, and you will hear from the UN, you will hear from a lot of critics of Israel. Oh no, Israel is inflaming the situation, they're making things worse. Actually not. What they are doing is destroying as much weaponry, including chemical weapons, so they don't fall into the hands of people who just a little while ago were associated with ISIS. Now, I understand the main rebel group has said they're moderated, they're going to make a deal to rule with the other groups, they're going to accommodate Christians, all the rest of it. But do we really know how this is going to turn out? We have seen this movie before. They start out moderate, and then they become crazier and crazier as things go on. And in any case, why do we want Syria to have a storehouse of weapons? Why do we want them to have a navy? Why do we want them to have chemical weapons? Of course we don't. So Israel is once again doing our work for us. And this is really kind of the point of what's going on in the Middle East. With the U.S. help, granted, we've given them intelligence, we've given them assistance, we've given them diplomatic cover, but really Israel itself has almost single-handedly devastated Hezbollah, devastated Hamas, put Iran on its heels, helped shove Assad out of the way because Iran was not available to help him, and made our life incredibly more accommodating, easier. It's going to be a more stable, more productive area. And you know what? Trump is getting all this on his silver platter. Yeah, Biden is handing him the opportunity of a lifetime. He has already presided over a ceasefire deal with Hezbollah. And I imagine that a Hamas deal is just around the corner. So he is going to hand off, understand this, to Trump. No wars in Israel, Iran back on its feet, Assad out of the picture, Israel reigning supreme. What could he do to screw this up? I don't know. I can imagine, actually. And what he would do would be to back the worst impulses of Bibi Netanyahu, who, by the way, is on trial and may have to go to jail, by encouraging to annex the West Bank, by encouraging him to be even more aggressive regarding the Palestinians. This would be a grave mistake because Donald Trump, after all, wants a Nobel Prize. You know he does. And the way to get there is to get Bibi and the Saudis together to reach an accommodation, something for the Palestinians, and declare peace in the Middle East. That's his road to the Nobel Peace Prize. He does not get there by encouraging Bibi and his worst right-wing allies to be the most extreme, the most obstreperous. That's counter to what Trump wants. And I have news for Bibi Netanyahu and the other people who think they're so smart, who think they can push Trump around, who think, oh, he loves Israel, oh, he's indebted to the Christian right. They fail to understand that Donald Trump only cares about Donald Trump. And he wants glory, he wants power, he wants revenge. And if the choice is between kicking Bibi to the curb and getting a Nobel Peace Prize and a peace deal in the Middle East, I have no doubt whatsoever he's going to choose the latter. So where does that leave the rest of the world and the United States. Well, once again, look what Trump is being handed. The economy is roaring. We just added 277,000 jobs. Unemployment is up just a tick, but 4.2% is really low. Wages are outrunning inflation. Trump is being handed a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We have up and running the most successful investment in infrastructure, in green energy, in chip manufacturing. All he has to do is not screw it up. Now, what would he do that would screw it up? Well, first of all, he would put in a bunch of incompetent crooks into office, and he will try. Secondly, he could actually pursue his mass deportation plan, which would absolutely kill both agriculture and the construction industry, which do depend on undocumented workers. Yes, they do. He could, of course, enter into a tariff war with our allies. How stupid would that be? Donald Trump getting into a trade war with Canada? Who does that benefit? Now, granted, he knows nothing about economics, but even he can see that that would be the wrong maneuver. And you only need to look at Europe, which is not exactly an economic colossus these days. The EU just did a free trade deal with South America. So what sense does it make for Donald Trump to get into a trade war with a bunch of countries that have just opened up their markets to our allies? Even Trump is smarter than that, I think. So that leaves, of course, these insane, corrupt, compromised nominees that he is trying to get through. Pete Hegseth, by the way, is the least of our troubles. He is morally repugnant, he's unfit, he's unqualified, but that doesn't make him the worst of the nominees. That award, I think, gets split between Kash Patel, who is promising to exact revenge and lock up the January 6th committee people, go after a long list of people. He is a QAnon conspiratorialist, and he would share the award for the worst nominee in the history of the Republic with Tulsi Gabbard. Now, there's been a lot of jokes floating around because, of course, she was a great admirer of Bashar al-Assad. And if I were her, I'd be a little bit worried because whatever's in those files, whatever intelligence, whatever communication, Assad doesn't control that anymore. So goodness knows what's going to come out about her. Listen, the Republicans would be nuts to approve either one of these people. And here's why. It's not because they care about democracy. It's not that they care about competent governance. If there is a terrorist attack, if there is an assault on the American service people, they will be blamed because they will have put in utterly incompetent, compromised people in important positions, national security positions. They will never live this down. Now, there are other horrendous nominees. Don't get me wrong. There's RFK Jr., who wants to cut off, I suppose, cutting-edge research, doesn't believe in vaccines. He's a complete nut. But thankfully, there is an army of medical professionals in Washington, D.C. There are state health professionals. Some of the governors are getting together to make sure they have a storehouse of not only Plan B medication, abortion medication, but also vaccines. In other words, he can be countered. He can be made up for. There is a way of backfilling that space. There's no way to make up for the fact if we are attacked by terrorists or if we preemptively engage in a war in the Middle East that turns out very badly. Those things can't be remedied by other people. There's no governor who's around to save us from that. So Republicans had better think long and hard before they put in intelligence and in national security positions, these lunatics. And I have news for them. Those people who are up in 2026, Susan Collins, Tom Tillis, Joni Ernst, they will be the first to go, because the American people will see them as responsible for whatever debacle that has unfolded. and they will lose their seats. So if you can't do the right thing because you love America, because you care about democracy, at least act in your own self-interest. That will be the biggest motivator for Republicans. Between global warming and rising energy bills, finding the right temperature at night is a struggle we all face. It can make it so hard to fall asleep, but recently I found a way to sleep in perfect comfort all night long. Whether you sleep too hot or even too cold, my secret is using thermoregulating, NASA-inspired, silver-infused bed sheets by Miracle Made. Their self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding even prevents 99.7% of bacteria, so they stay fresher three times longer. That means three times less laundry, too. Thanks to Miracle Made, you'll stop sleeping on bacteria that can clog your pores and lead to breakouts and acne. They even eliminate bad odors, so your bed always feels freshly made. Life is much more comfortable and clean with Miracle Made. Their temperature-regulating, silver-infused fabrics were inspired by NASA to give you maximum comfort no matter how high the heater is set. Just picture how great it will be to get better sleep every night. Plus, Miracle Sheets feel soft and luxurious without the high price tag of other luxury brands. They even feel nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels, so you feel like you're on vacation every time you get into bed. I imagine I'm in the south of France, or maybe it's in Gstaad, Switzerland, whichever. You ask yourself, what part of dreamland will Miracle Made take you to? Miracle has a whole line of comfortable, self-cleaning bedding, pillowcases, and comforters. I know you'll love them. So how do you get these things? Go to trymiracle.com/greenroom to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo greenroom at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Remember, go to trymiracle.com/greenroom and use the code GREENROOM to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/greenroom to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. You can look for the link in the show notes. Everybody has a theory about the election. Why Trump won? Was it Kamala Harris's fault? Was it Joe Biden's fault? But frankly, I'm a little tired of that discussion, and I'm much more interested in going forward, what Democrats need to do, what they can do to prepare themselves to win in the future. I think we get the sense that the current state of affairs is going to go on indefinitely. But listen, Donald Trump was elected in 2016, and 4 years later, he was out of office. So 4 years is an eternity. And remember, there are midterm elections coming up in 2026. And even before that, there are state elections in New Jersey and Virginia, where they're going to choose not only state legislators, but also the governors. So who do I think has some insight into policy, strategy, and personnel that I think Democrats are going to need to pull themselves up out of this hole that they have dug? Well, I always go to Third Way. They are a center-left think tank that does research, that does advocacy work. They were very much responsible for chasing No Labels out of the race in 2024. They've done remarkable research, for example, on gun deaths in red states as compared to blue states. And they do a lot more. So I am delighted to have the executive director of policy, Jim Kessler, and we're going to talk about all that and more. Welcome to the show, Jim.
It's great to be here.
It is always fun to chat. As I was saying, I'm less interested in how we got to the state of affairs, meaning that Republicans control the trifecta, and much more interested on what to do going forward. Let's talk for a moment about policy and ideology. We know a lot of Americans, frankly, don't care and don't follow it. They vote on personality, they vote on whatever video they saw, whatever their neighbor said about the candidates. But it does matter to a great many people. And if you're concerned about policy, it matters what politicians believe. Do you think that Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were essentially in the right place ideologically? Or do you think the Democratic Party needs to make some either big or little adjustments in where they fall on the political spectrum?
Yeah, so I think Joe Biden ran in 2020 in the right place, and then he governed in some ways in the right place, and then I feel he lost his way. And then as for Harris, I think Harris had 6 months when she ran for president in the Democratic primary where she became a person that she wasn't and paid the price. And then just also, and this is not quite ideology, but it bleeds into ideology, I think Democrats as a whole have become a party that's forgotten how to listen. And it talks to a lot of the interest groups, but the interest groups aren't necessarily the people that those interest groups say that they represent. And I think we've fallen into lazy habits, and it came home to roost. And we missed where voters were.
Very interesting. Let's break that down. Where do you think Biden was essentially in the right place? And where do you think he may have lost his way and lost momentum, frankly?
So I think a lot of the legislation that you have written about quite a bit and that our organization Third Way supported, like the CHIPS and Science Act and the infrastructure bill, definitely part of the American Rescue Plan, you know, other legislation that they did, even the gun and also the gun legislation, I think these were definitely in the right place.
Right.
I think in a lot of places where they were in the wrong place, it was by omission.
Interesting.
So, you know, we saw in June of 2024 that when you did the right executive actions at the border, you basically could control the border. And that should have been done years ago.
Right.
And I also think on the issue of crime, and look, the crime rate has dropped. And I think on the Biden policies on crime have been pretty good, which has been funding the police and some gun measures, et cetera. But there were examples of things that are going on in places like Seattle and San Francisco and Portland, where you can make that as an example of something that has gone out of control. And as a president say, this can't continue, and send a signal to voters that you won't tolerate chaos. And I think they didn't do that because they didn't want to offend anybody. And as a result, they lost the middle.
What you have described is something that I call a muscular progressivism. In other words, that the American people basically like the government doing constructive things, not taking over industries, but helping private industry get going in the right direction, helping working people to manage their lives more easily. But they also care very much about personal security, which is what you're talking about. They care about it in foreign policy. They care about it at the border. They care about it on crime. And simply citing the statistics back to them did not seem to do the trick, because everybody has a personal experience. They know someone who is the victim of crime, or they go into the drugstore and they see those cabinets that are locked up that drive everyone crazy. That may seem like a small thing, but it's actually a pretty big thing because it's in their face every day. What are the kinds of things? And by the way, I think Kamala Harris got it better in the campaign, certainly than she had in 2018, 2019, and frankly, a little bit better than Biden did during the campaign because she leaned back into her role as a prosecutor, talked about drugs, talked about crime. What are the kinds of things that Democrats should be saying and doing which convinces the average American that they get it, that they understand these kinds of big and little problems that arise from crime?
Right. And I agree with you. I think Kamala Harris really did move in the right direction. I thought she ran, I wouldn't give it an A-plus campaign, but it was an A-minus campaign, which is usually good enough. And she was also carrying a lot of anvils behind her.
Right.
Some of her own making from 2018, 2019, some not of her own making. Look, I think part of this is you have to acknowledge what voters are experiencing. And I know in this town, you know, I was hearing from definitely retail organizations about like shoplifting being a huge problem.
Yep.
And then, of course, I can just walk into the CVS in Silver Spring, Maryland, and or you know, the Safeway in D.C. And it's like it's almost on lockdown. These places. So one of the things is like, don't deny people's personal experience.
Right.
The other thing I'd say is, I think Democrats have fallen into the habit, and it's not a bad thing. It's just they're overusing we're the party of the future muscle.
Yeah.
So you look at all the things like infrastructure, the CHIPS bill, you know, investing in kids, investing in prevention, you know, investing in schools. It's all about the future. And you have to realize also when you're in a right now election and it's gas prices and grocery prices and the feeling that crime is on the rise and the feeling that the border is out of control. And we did not balance what we're looking for the future and what people are experiencing right now. This was a right now election.
That's fascinating. You know, what you were saying really gets reflected in the best of the Democratic candidates. I did an interview recently with Tammy Baldwin, and she talks about going to counties and reminding them, hey, I was the one who got you the small business loan to help you get through the winter where there wasn't enough snow for the snowmobile business. I was the one who helped make sure that Obamacare allowed you to keep your child on the insurance plan until age 26. In other words, there's a level of granularity, particularity that some Democrats understand and know how to communicate. Can you scale that up? Can a presidential candidate do it? Can a governor do it to really kind of get down to the nuts and bolts so people know what you're talking about as opposed to a generic term of, you know, helping the little guy or helping the farmers? Do they need that level of specificity?
They do. And look, Tammy Baldwin is someone who was never favored in an election.
Right.
Okay. So she's like, look, I'm going to have to work harder than everybody else. And I'm going to have to make this case. And I'm under no illusion that under the best circumstance, I win by 3 points.
Right.
You know, so she plays a different game. Now, I worked for Chuck Schumer for 8 years. Okay. 6 in the House, 2 in the Senate. We did Sunday press conferences pretty much every Sunday. And every one of those Sunday press conferences was on an issue that touched people and that you would never know if he was a Democrat or Republican, like the high price of cereal.
Right.
You know, or lab rats escaping out of some facility in Queens. Schumer had this saying, no problem is too big and no problem is too small for me. And I think you need to be there on that.
It's interesting you should say that. I'm sure you remember Ronald Reagan, who had his weekly radio address. Granted, Democrats are out of power, but shouldn't they create some new listening habits, kind of be more present in the conversation? Everyone, I think, wanted a break from politics. They thought Donald Trump was overexposed, but there's a danger going in the other direction. What are some ways, do you think, that they can stay present in people's minds without annoying them and make sure that the average person understands the little things and the big things that they're doing?
Yeah, so I think they need to get out. I think you need to get away from the groups. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think you just, you know, polling isn't listening and talking to the groups isn't listening. Okay. So I think going out there and doing some listening. The other thing is this. We have a huge problem in the interior of the country. So there are 19 states that touch the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. Kamala Harris won 14 of those 19. There are 32 states that do not. Kamala Harris won 6. Trump won 26. Two of them that we won were Vermont and DC. DC is not really a state. And so the reason why that is significant, it's not just that we're a coastal party, but if you look at the Democratic coalition right now, it's college-educated whites, blacks of all income levels, and then a smattering of other folks. Well, a lot of the college-educated whites, they don't have the same day-to-day problems that the rest of the country has. Like, I'll use me as an example. Like, I definitely notice high gas prices and high grocery prices, but I can shrug them off. So we need to, because we are not representing in a lot of ways folks that are dealing with day-to-day problems and states that are dealing with day-to-day problems. You know, parts of this country, they're doing great. And other parts of this country, they haven't been doing great for 20 years.
Right.
So we have to get in better touch with the places of the country that feels like, when is it going to be my turn?
Right. It's interesting. I've looked to, perhaps because they're the highest ranking officials that are still Democrats, but the governors. We yeah. really do have a tremendous group of governors. And I'm not saying that just to be flattering, but when you look back, you have some of the more dynamic, the most innovative, and they do win in the heartland. They do win in Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin. What do they get that other Democrats need to pick up on? And are they better at maintaining a presence in people's lives?
Definitely. And mayors are special too.
Yes.
Because they're dealing with everyday things, you know, they're dealing with storms, you yeah. know, and snow removal, you know, no president is dealing with snow removal. Once upon a time, senators never were getting elected. Remember, it was always yeah. governor, governor, governor. And then Barack Obama got elected. That sort of broke the streak. And then Joe Biden again. And look, I think for Democrats, if you want to get back in touch, probably governors are the right way to go. I mean, look, Kamala Harris ran a great race. She wants to run again. She'll be the prohibitive favorite. Not a knock against her. But boy, governors are closer to the ground, right. you know.
And they win in the interior, as you have pointed out.
Yes.
So if you want to capture those people, it sure helps that there's someone who has a firsthand understanding of them. One of the issues that I have heard from Democrats, and I was talking to Abigail Spanberger, who is a rising star for people who don't know, former CIA, elected to the House in 2018. She's now running for governor of Virginia. Very moderate, very plugged in Democrat. One of the things she says is people are sick of the negativity. Even if they agree with you when you're critiquing Donald Trump, they don't want to hear it. Is the message too reactive? Is the conversation too negative? Or are they just compelled to do that because Donald Trump is going to be doing a lot of terrible things that are going to hurt a lot of people? What's the balance between the positive and the negative, do you think?
That is such a delicate balance out there because, you know, people always say they hate negative and a lot of times negative works. And I do think that Trump's negatives on Harris were more effective than Harris's negatives on Trump. Thought, you know, I was out, I spent a lot of time in Ohio and they weren't necessarily Trump ads, but they were ads against Sherrod Brown. And you'd see those ads and be like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Look, we're in a society now where on everything you're fed the negative.
Yeah.
And if you're on social media, like the algorithms are designed, like right. they're designed to make you angry. This is an angry country. And, you know, I think Harris tried to be positive and tried to bring joy out there. And, you know, she had the she had the challenge of having to define herself in 100+ days because people didn't really notice her. But I think Spanberger's thesis deserves to be tested.
Yeah.
You know, and I agree with you. I think she is a special one. And I hope she gets elected governor of Virginia, and I expect she'll be an excellent governor. You know, I think, but her and some of the other governors you're talking about, Gretchen Whitmer, Jared Polis, you know, Josh Shapiro and others, Pritzker and others, like they're focusing on what we can do.
Right.
You know.
Right. And it's interesting. One of the things I think that doesn't get spoken about enough is not what Trump is going to do to people. He's going to do a lot of bad things, but the void, the vacuum that's going to be opened up if the federal government, for example, stops funding research or is more lax in drug enforcement or whatever it is. And that's where, you know, the governors kind of step into the breach. So saying that you're going to be there for your folks, even if the federal government is in some kind of tizzy, seems to be kind of a compelling message. And we've seen some of that. We've seen some compacts where the governors are trying to band together to buy vaccines or buy Plan B abortion medication. What are some of the positive things that governors can do either individually or collectively? So again, people know that they're fighting for them as opposed to some other big interests.
Well, you definitely mentioned two of those, and I think there's going to be plenty on the healthcare side because it's hard to know what the extent of the damage that could be caused to Obamacare and Medicaid and the CHIPS program, which is for child health and vaccines and also on contraception. So I think that is a target-rich area.
Yeah.
You know, for governors to find solutions that affect people, that touch people. There are some places where they're going to be helpless. Like if there are Trump tariffs and that grinds the economy, I mean, then you're just trying to bail out the damage.
Right.
At that point.
Right. But that then does give Democrats certainly a rallying cry. You know, one of the things that has aggravated people from time immemorial, and it got worse during COVID because the schools were closed, was education. Trump's answer to everything is close down the education department. And Democrats too often said, oh, keep the education department open. And people asked, like, what does the education department do? They just want something for their kids. What are some ways that Democrats have talked about and done things in the schools that have resonated with people, particularly in those areas in the heartland that you've been talking about?
Well, I think just going back on what you said, I think one of the places where the Democrats missed an opportunity under Biden was to be the party of trying to reform government and make voters feel that we were answering their concerns about government that is not just big, but maybe lazy and sloppy post-COVID.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it's like people working from home in the federal government and getting more people coming to work, but also ways that in which voters were convinced, like, we're going to try and make sure you get a dollar's worth of government for a dollar's worth of taxes. I think that was a missed opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. Look, the Department of Education sends a lot of money to local school districts, particularly on areas like special needs kids, low income kids, of course, nutrition, but also on like setting standards and making sure that graduation rates are decent and that kids are learning something. And, part of also what Department of Education does is best practices so that other schools can learn, how to address different education issues. So I imagine eliminating the Department of Education will not be a winner for Republicans.
With HelloFresh, you get farm fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. There are no trips to the grocery store, No planning, no menus, no grocery lists, and no wasted ingredients. So count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. You'll feel great knowing that every HelloFresh recipe includes high-quality, sustainably sourced ingredients. The produce comes fresh from the farm, and it tastes so much better when it hasn't been sitting on the shelves for weeks. Plus, HelloFresh makes it easy to save valuable time during the busy holiday season by eliminating trips to the grocery store. They have something for everyone, with over 100 add-on items that you add to your weekly box, like quick breakfasts, packable snacks, and beverages, and more. With so many options, you'll always be ready to whip up incredible meals for any occasion. I will say, having just broken my wrist, HelloFresh was a lifesaver. No measuring, no scooping. I just opened the packages, put the ingredients together, and cook. It was the easiest thing possible. But even if you're not in distress, you'll get a wonderful meal for the holidays, and you can actually talk to your guests. You don't have to be in the kitchen slaving away all day long. You don't have to go to the grocery store. It's so convenient. So this is how HelloFresh works with your schedule. Their plans are flexible, and you can change your meal preferences, update your delivery day, and change your address with just a few taps on the HelloFresh app. I'm so glad I started my subscription, and I know you will be too. Don't wait. Right now, they have a special deal for you. Get 10 free meals at HelloFresh.com/free-greenroom, applied across 7 boxes. New subscribers only, vary by plan. That's 10 free HelloFresh meals. Just go to HelloFresh.com/free-greenroom. Everyone can also look for the link to HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit, in the show notes. It also seems that very often, and perhaps this is because they talk to the groups, as you say, the teachers' unions being a one, that they talk more about the teachers than about the kids. They talk about a teacher's right to talk about something or other. Has there been too much emphasis on, you know, the cultural issues, these hot flashpoints, and not enough on, let's get your kid caught up because they're still 6 months or 9 months or 12 months behind because of COVID? In other words, is there kind of a level of practicality that people would like to hear as opposed to whatever the latest, you know, fuss is over, you know, DEI or, you know, some other issue like that?
Yeah, and I can say that as someone who was a kid that was in high school during COVID, yep. And yep. You know, in a DC public school, and is in college, and, you know, is behind in some areas because other kids went back to school earlier.
Yep.
And I think for voters, you know, if Democrats were getting back to the fundamentals of, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, there and having you feel like your kid going to these schools is going to be okay and get ahead, I think that's job number one.
Right.
And it's easy to get distracted on all the other cultural issues. And they certainly, I mean, they arise organically, these cultural issues. You can't just completely ignore them, but they seem to have dominated the debate. And I think the Democrats, you know, need to get back to the fundamentals, the ABCs.
Right. You mentioned tariffs as a possible economic train wreck. Another, frankly, would be mass deportation of people. And you now, for the first time, are hearing from the construction industry and from the agriculture folks that saying, oh, we can't lose, you know, a few million people from our workforce. What is the best argument to the American people when Trump tries this? Is it a moral argument, a political argument, a economic argument? How do they talk about it in a way that people don't say, oh yeah, we're in favor of getting rid of several million people who are here illegally? What's the right framing for them?
If you remember back in the Trump administration, immigration was a problem for him.
Yep.
And there was a surge at the border.
Yep.
Not as big as the surge that happened under Biden, but bigger than any surge under Obama. And then the child separation policies
right.
bit them. In some ways, the pictures tell the story. And if we're seeing mass deportations, and you're right, there's going to be economic problems with that, that voters will feel.
Yep.
There will be, it's inflationary, yep. okay? And it's going to hurt a whole lot of businesses. I mean, it's stagflationary,
yes.
to be honest with you.
Yes.
But also, like, if they're arresting people and deporting people who their only crime is that they're here illegally, and, you know, it's the cleaning lady and the person on the construction crew or the home health care aide, like, those are very ugly pictures.
Yeah.
In the past, Americans have reacted strongly to that.
Right.
They reacted strongly in the 50s in the civil rights. I mean, television is what propelled the civil rights movement.
Right.
And so I'm not sure it's the framing. It might be what you're seeing on your TV screen.
Interesting. One of the things that Third Way has focused on, and I've picked up on it because I think it's so important, is the disparity in outcomes and quality of life between states that have Democratic governors, for shorthand, blue states, and those that are red states. You guys have done phenomenal work on the gun issue and right. on murder rates. But really, when you look at it across the board, whether it's longevity, whether it's child poverty, there is such a difference between what Democratic governors produce and what red states produce. I don't think that's very well known, both to the people who are in red states who just think that's the way things have to be, or frankly, the people in blue states who understandably always have some complaint or another. What's the best way that people understand that the choice of governor matters, that you get radically different outcomes depending upon who's running your state? How do you communicate that?
Yeah. And, you know, going to the murder rates, like, red states have had higher murder rates than blue states for 23 consecutive years.
And most people do not know that.
No, they don't. When I said that, I was at a congressional hearing and I said that, I mean, people reacted like I said, like, well, you have three eyes. Like
right.
they thought that's absolutely impossible. Mississippi has a murder rate four times that of New York City.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy stuff. It's interesting because I think Republicans do a fantastic job of distracting voters into, you know, looking at some other issues that, like, really raise your emotions.
Yep.
And may in some way have a direct impact on you, but not so much so. You know, I think they did a great job with, like, trans kids in sports.
Right.
You know, that's, let's face it, it's not affecting that many people exactly. in the world. And, you know, they become very emotional issues. And, like, we're talking about murder rates, and maybe you and I are comfortable with that because we love long algebra, you know, long division. But, and I do think also, you know, I've been on a lot of conservative media and talked about, let's say, murder rates. And they said, like, yeah, but that's happening in blue cities and red states. I'm like, well, blue states have blue cities too.
Right. Right.
You know, I just think that people's lived experience, they're guided by that. And they're not, if they're feeling it, they don't seem to be feeling it. Mississippians, I guess, don't feel afraid.
Yeah.
But they feel afraid if they were in New York City.
Yeah. It is hard sometimes to communicate what's real and what's not. And that raises really an issue that did get some attention during the campaign, is getting a lot of attention now among Democrats, and that is where they communicate. You have a very few handful of people who will go on Fox, for example. Pete Buttigieg is sort of the model.
I'm one of them.
And you're one of them. Do they have to be more heterogeneous in the media that they interact with, whether it's podcasts, whether it's right-wing media, whether it's online groups? Have they kind of gotten obsessed with, you know, going on Face the Nation and to the exclusion of other things? What's the best way to be able to reach the most people, which is what a politician needs to do.
So I do go on Fox. I've gone on Fox a lot. And I've talked to other Democrats about going on more often. And I have to say, like, it's hard to go on Fox. As a Democrat going on Fox, I remember the first few times I did it, it's like, I'm going to outsmart these people. And instead, I got mowed over.
Yep.
Like, you really have to prepare. You have to be good. You need a strategy going in. They'll take you down. So it's an unpleasant experience. And then you get all sorts of crazy stuff emailed to you. And sometimes you get the phone calls and that sort of thing. So it's you need a stomach for it. But, you know, I think that, look, I think Democrats have been, we're the legacy status quo institutionalist party right now. We need to break out of that, you know? Right. And so there are a lot of rebels out there. Like, let's just say Joe Rogan. I don't love Joe Rogan. I don't support Joe Rogan, whatever. But, like, I wish we were on Joe Rogan more. Like, we need to engage.
Right.
And you know, the world has changed and we're, you know, yeah, we're still stuck with, you know, Face the Nation and we need to expand our reach. And it's also important, like, when you go on these shows, like, I go on Fox a lot. I don't love it. But when I'm in the green room and I'm listening to Fox for 45 minutes before I go on, like, I have a great sense of what Republicans are going to be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And what voters are seeing.
They are predictable, if nothing else. And you really do begin to develop, you know, a way of combating that the more you listen to them. The DNC is just beginning a campaign for its chairman. And I've been quite open about the fact, I think Ben Wickler, who's the chairman of Wisconsin, is a great candidate for that. Has the DNC become irrelevant? Is it as important as it used to be because we now have all this dark money and the focus is elsewhere? Or could it play a bigger role in the things we've been talking about, communicating, focus, really a sense of presence in people's lives? Could it do more than it has been doing?
If we have the right person. And I agree with you. I think Ben would be an excellent choice. We need someone from the interior of the country. We need someone who has a vision for what a party apparatus can do. And, you know, he was chairman of a state party.
Right.
I thought, you know, look, I didn't support Howard Dean when he ran for president, but I thought the way he was as chairman of the DNC, he had a vision that said, like, we're going to compete in 50 states.
Right.
And in 3,128 counties, and we're going to be everywhere. And, like, I thought that was a vision, a legitimate vision. So the party's not relevant. The DNC is not relevant when you have the presidency.
Yeah.
But it becomes much more relevant when you don't.
Interesting.
And so I think it can set a tone and a direction for the party. You know, I just want to say just one more thing on this. Like, Kamala Harris, she won 226 electoral college votes. If she'd won the three blue wall states, that would have gotten her to 270. Okay. In 2032, based on the census, her same states plus the three blue wall states gets her to 256.
Yeah.
Okay. So we better start thinking beyond our narrow map of how to get to 270 pretty soon, because we're going to have to start winning in places where we're not only not winning very often now, but where we're losing by a pretty good margin.
Right.
And so, like, I think the right chair can help do that.
Interesting. One of the things he talks about that I have seen up close, because I've been to Wisconsin more times than I ever imagined I would be, is the notion of a permanent campaign. And I think what he means by that is building on each win. If you have a state Supreme Court race, you got to win it because that's going to determine redistricting. You then got to win those races. In other words, to keep the momentum going rather than having to reinvent the wheel every time out. Do you think that's possible to spread that kind of mantra to other states so that you keep the core of active volunteers. You keep people engaged to continue to press the issues?
I think it's a good idea to do it because not only are you keeping voters engaged, but you're communicating with voters, and that's going up and down the chain.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, part of the active listening that I feel the Democrats have to do. And I would also say that, you know, Democrats are really focused on winning 2 years from now, 4 years from now. But I think really starting about 50 years ago, Republicans were focused on winning 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And they planted a lot of seeds in a lot of different places that, you know, are bearing fruit today. Now it is a wholly different Republican Party than the one that was envisioned in the 70s and 80s when this was really happening.
Right.
I think it is a perverse version of that. But they've done very, very well at the local level and of course, now at the national level.
Right. When you look around the country, I try to call attention these days because it's kind of dismal at the national level and say, here's a handful of people that are really doing a great job. Keep an eye on them. I mentioned Abigail Spanberger. Give us some names of governors, mayors, and people at the national level who you think have kind of figured out both the substance and the message that Democrats might be able to learn from.
I think Justin Bibb, who's the mayor of Cleveland, is an interesting guy.
Interesting.
Young African-American, you know, really trying to rebuild the city. I think he's interesting. I think Richie Torres is very interesting.
Congressman from New York.
Yeah, from the Bronx. And very smart, not afraid. You mentioned Abigail Spanberger for sure. Alyssa Slotkin, who just got elected in Michigan.
Right. Excellent.
Yeah, and someone who I hope will be a pain in the ass in the Senate.
Right.
Even to my former boss, Chuck Schumer, you know, those are some of the names that come to mind for me.
Right. No, I agree. And I like to tout that three of the people that I featured in my book on women coming back after the 2016 race were Mikey Sherrill, who is now running for governor of New Jersey, Abigail Spanberger, and Elise Slotkin.
Yeah.
Coincidence? Maybe. But, you know, listen, you could tell that these people were stars from the get-go. They have a certain command. And I think this background in national security, even if they're not talking national security, that I think gives people some confidence. It exudes a certain stability, a certain awareness that there are dangers out there. And I think women with national security backgrounds in the Democratic Party are pretty golden. So I would encourage people to keep an eye on that. Let me close on this. Are you optimistic in the short run that Democrats can figure this out? Are you pessimistic in the short term? What's your kind of general outlook and how we can begin this process? It's a long process, as you said. It's not going to be done in a year, an election. What gives you some optimism that, yes, they can figure this out?
I'm an optimist by nature. I'm not sure where I am on the optimist-pessimist meter right now because it's fluctuating quite a bit.
Yeah.
I know that Democrats will eventually figure it out because we've done it in the past and we will in the future. What I'm not sure is if we need to take another drubbing first.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Or we get smart right away.
Right.
You know.
Right. I think that's an excellent note to end on. And the fortunate thing is we do have two states that have gubernatorial and legislative races next year. So perhaps that's a good testing ground to see how much they've learned in the preceding months. So thank you, Jim, for coming on. It is always good to talk to you. I would encourage people to go to Third Way. You will always find something interesting at the website, a study, an argument you haven't thought about, a point of view. I wish you continued luck as we head through another Trump term.
Oy.
Oy is right. Thanks so much for joining us, Jim.
Thank you.
And that was Jim Kessler. I told you he was a smart guy. I think what I take away from that discussion is that Democrats should not overcorrect in attempting to do something wild and extreme to reposition themselves. Frankly, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, in terms of policy and ideology, were right about where the American people are. Obviously, there was an anti-incumbency bias. There was an inflation problem. Kamala Harris didn't have enough time to differentiate herself from a very unpopular president. But that's not the arena of policy. And I think, if anything, they need to double down on communicating what it is that they stand for. They stand for important and useful programs like the infrastructure bill, like the CHIPS and Science Act, like the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think Jim is right that they need to double and triple down on a approach to the border, to foreign policy, and to crime that convinces Americans they have their interests at stake, that they have their interests in mind when they decide that they are going to craft policies that hopefully help the police and the police's relationship with communities. So let's hope that in the months and years ahead, Democrats take that advice to heart. They need to develop candidates from the heartland, I think. They need to do a much better job communicating to all sorts of people. They have to get off, frankly, the Sunday talk shows, which have small audiences of people who don't need to be persuaded of everything. They know what they want, and they know who they want to vote for already. They need to figure out how to communicate with the larger American public. And if they do that, and if they are able to tie Trump and the Republicans to the bad things that are going to happen because they have bad policies in mind, then I think they're going to pull themselves out of the slump. And I think the country will be fine. So a absolutely vigorous opposition to Trump, touting the accomplishments of skilled Democratic governors, and finding candidates who are appropriate to their districts and their states for 2026. That should be easy, right? Well, easier said than done. Let's wish them luck. If you enjoyed this program, you enjoyed our other programs, please tell your friends. They can follow us wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.